Now this is Channel 2 Right. This is Channel 2 Right, and a continuation of a visit with Louise Graham on our second visit over here when she finished the tape of the music at the Gospel Sing. And we talked a good bit too. And this is Friday, the 19th of September, 69. Friday, the 19th of September, 69. This is Channel 2 Right. This is Channel 2 Right.
And we have one, you know, I still have my big bulldozer. So, we still have it. You know, Hardy just bought it 3 months before he died. Have always wanted one, and we had got our first payment from Stucky.
Oh.
And he had got his bulldozer and used it 3 months.
Oh.
And I said, there's three things. Man wanted to buy my truck. I said, Lord, man, there's three things that'll never be sold. I said, there's not even money enough in Lotway County to buy three pieces of equipment that I got. And I said, that's my pickup, my little old Ford tractor, and my bulldozer. And I said, the pickup, Mr. Graham was in it when he took sick, and he loved his little old new tractor, and he always wanted a bulldozer, and he finally got that.
Yeah.
But see, that's it. Andrew knows every, now these big drag lines, or these big payloaders, anything. And he's mechanically minded with them. He can fix any kind of power saw.
Yeah.
And
you know,
I got on his head a while ago. Let me tell you what little jackass done.
Yeah.
I worried about getting my tables fixed for my reunion out there. Me and little Hart built to fix those tables, put new boards on. He needed three long boards a while ago. He didn't do a thing but back up there in his pickup and take my three boards off of my table. And I went right on in behind him, and I says, let me tell you one God-blamed thing. You carry my clean boards that we done scrubbed up and put right back there on that table, and go right out in that barn. Now, you'll excuse this. And I said, you get right out into that barn and get those boards just filled full of chicken pigeon mess, and put them up. He just wanted to cross the road with the darn tractor.
Yeah.
And took my clean boards we'd scrubbed up and put on the table.
Yeah.
That's what Bob.
Well, now look, Louise, I just want you to talk a little bit. I want you to want to know some things you're interested in. Sometimes a person has just got to speak up like that anywhere he goes, in town or anywhere around.
No, and they just take advantage of me. Now, I about paid $12.50 for a ski rope just to pull the kids back of my boat.
Yeah.
I don't ski. I just drive for them to ski.
Yeah.
Went out to get in my truck today, and I'd be darned if they didn't have a sleeping bag. They had cut my ski rope to tie up the darn sleeping bag.
Yeah.
I said, this has been a bad day for me.
Yeah.
First old drunk, and now they cut my
ski rope. I've got to work your thing there. Tell me, what are some of the things that you've had a hand in over at Micanopy? Tell me just a few of them. I don't mean I've never known anybody who's public spirited like you are.
Can I plug this in?
Sure.
The biggest project I think I undertook is I was president of the Cemetery Association.
Yeah.
Citywide, and I mean statewide, I should say. And they, long years ago, a man, Mr. Powell, left $500 to the Cemetery Association for the interest to be used at the upkeep of the cemetery. Well, they've been wanting more works in the cemetery, and none of them ever shouldered the job of getting it done. So they elected me president of the Micanopy Cemetery Association. I didn't even have anybody buried in there, but I was just interested in it and didn't have any cousins. So I put myself to the wheel, and we took the interest that had accumulated on that $500, which was $900 and some. And I got around, and we put running water all over the cemetery. And we put a fence around the cemetery the 3 years that I was president of the Cemetery Association. And then one thing that I am very, very proud of course, I didn't do this by myself, but I had a big dip in it. See, the Masons had tried to finish their temple there for years and years and years. And my father was, he was next to his home. He loved his Masonic Lodge. And I know they was going to buy the old Fountain building, the one that fell in. And he says, "Why, boys, we can build a temple." And he was 8 years old then. So that was one of his greatest wishes for the Masons, to have a temple. So we formed the Macanoka Civic Club. And I was the first president. And all of us clubbed together, and we gave suppers. Each organization, the president of each organization, was on the committees. Now, I was president of the Cemetery Association, so I was in it on that. And I was on the recreation board, so that I got in on the civic, on the building of the temple out of it. Anyhow, I had about four hands in the pie. But anyhow, the women and all of us got together, and we finished that Masonic temple. You see like it is now. And the bottom floor is supposed to be the Macanoka Civic Club, and upstairs is the lodge. But after, you see, when they discarded our school, Walter Eblin and I went to the school board, and we asked that they let us have the school building in order to keep the Negroes from going in there. See, I started school the first day of my life there, and it was very dear to me. So they leased us the school for $1 a year. So I went to the county commissioners, I met with them, and they gave me $500 to convert one room into the health department. See, we had a little room up at Ms. Daly's old place, and so they fixed us a nice health department down there in one room, and the Boy Scouts has one room, and now the town council's using it. And upstairs, if you love good music, you ought to come there on the first and third Saturday night, and you'd record a lot of that stuff. It's just home talent from all around here. Saturday night, they've got a good one.
I didn't know about it.
The prisoners from down here.
I was by there one nice Saturday night, and I saw the people there, and I said to myself, well, what they doing?
Well, the place is packed every Saturday night from all over this country.
Yes.
I'm telling you, from way up above Baldwin, clear down to Weirsdale in Bellevue, people come, and we have some children that's out of this world. We got a little boy there about 7, 8 years old that can beat all you ever seen singing. We got one little old Jap girl, and she just sings beautiful. And it's all just young talent, except down we have the Dixie Ramblers, which James Beck's in, and the boy, the prisoners from down at Lowell,
Yeah. They
are coming, and they're going to dedicate some songs to me Saturday night. So that's the reason why I didn't go to the river.
Now, wait a minute, I want to ask you something else. I can't hear. My hearing is sort of curious. Let me put it over here, or I won't get it in my ears. Now, that'll get you.
Mm-hmm. And we have three Smith children. One's a drummer, and one plays the guitar. And the little girl is about 14, and
Yeah. Then
they got one about 5.
Yeah. Well, now, let me tell you. On getting things done, Flora said, I don't know where she said it, Flora Richardson. I mean, she said, there's one thing you have to say about Louise Graham when she comes around in the organization, it'll move. And she says, people cuss her, but she gets things done. Now, what did they cuss you for, Louise?
Look, all I'm so bullheaded, I guess.
Well,
but now I know why she said that.
Uh-huh.
We have tried to build a new parsonage for 20 years.
Yeah.
And every time we've tried to build this parsonage, Carol Hare has been on the committee. Well, when Brother Morris come here and he wanted to build a parsonage, someone went to him and said, now, if you want to build that parsonage, don't put Carol Hare on the parsonage committee, on the building committee, put Louise Graham on it. My God, they met down here at Evingston, and they put me on I was one woman with 7 men on the building committee,
Yeah. On
the finding committee.
Yeah.
Well, Carol Emerson and I was from our church. Well, you see, we had $7,500 of our part to raise. That was mine and Carol's business. Evingston had so much, Shiloh had so much, and Waukehuda had so much. But we had half, and the rest of them done that other half. So, we went around and got the pledges. Joe Hare pledged $1,000. And we thought, you know, when we got everything in, we'd go to Joe and he'd give it. Well, we went, and we got down to $2,200. We couldn't get no more money to save our life. I went to Ben Franklin, and Ben Franklin gave me a check for $1,500 for our Sunday school and church, our parsonage. And they said nobody in the world would have got it down of him but me. I went, sent him a letter, and he says, "Now, Louise, when you make your final roundup, if you lack any, come back." Well, we finally got it down to $1,500. So he done give us five. He give us five more. He said, "I can't give you no more." Well, we went to Joe Hare. But we had this meeting. And we went to Joe first, so. And he said he'd give the $1,000 at a certain time. So the superintendent and all of us met at the church. We lacked $536. But we was counting on Joe's $1,000, you see. We hadn't got it, but we was counting on it. So, our superintendent was there, Brother Sykes, Dr. Sykes. And some of them made mention that we had pledges enough to pay the $536. And they felt like the bank would loan it to us on the pledges, see. And Joe Hare said, "Well, if we have to give a note our mortgage, who will have to sign it?" And Dr. Sykes spoke up and said, "Well, the trustees of the church." Joe says, "Well, I won't sign it." He says, "Now we can make this money up." Said, "I told them I'd give $1,000. I would give the last $1,000. And said, "If you all gonna have to borrow any," says, "I'll just withdraw my $1,000. You'll just have to borrow 15 instead of 5. Well, now, wasn't that little? I looked right at Dr. Sykes. I said, "Dr. Sykes, would it be permissible for someone else other than a trustee of the church to sign this note if they have collateral to take care of it?" He says, "Well, who do you mean, Ms. Graham?" I says, "I do. I'll sign it if I can." He says, "Well, I'll talk it over with the Board of Missions and let you know in a few days." So in a couple of days, he called me and says, "Ms. Graham, can you meet me at the bank?" Me and Brother Morris went to the bank and I signed the note and we got the money. So when it got down to the last $36, I told Noel Mountain, she was our treasurer, I said, "Now I'm going to pay that those last few dollars." And so I kept telling her to let me know how it was coming down. So I was getting ready to leave, and she told me that it was $36, so I just gave her a check for $36. So we paid off our note. But now that's Mark and Flora and all of them was right there working along with me, and they know. But what happened, though, Carol Hare, she wanted to build a $20,000 parsonage. Well, we couldn't do it. Back 10, 12 years ago, a $20,000 parsonage was something. Then they wanted to put, Mr. Evans gave us a lot down there on the lake. They wanted to build it down there. Well, that fell through. So then she tried to remodel the old parsonage, pay $8,000 on that 100-year-old building. Well, that fell through. And nothing she started became a reality, you see. So they just was so hell-bent that my efforts would be in vain. That's the reason why they withdrew that $1,000. I could have got $1,000 for Joe's place and we'd have paid it back right on and on and on. But he come across with it. He just felt like he couldn't be that little. And
How did you manage to get old Ben Franklin to do that?
Well, you know, Ben Franklin and I have always been, Hoyt was in business. We worked with, Lord, I wish I had all the money Ben Franklin ever paid us. See, we hauled logs. Mr. Graham was in the lumber business, timber business with Franklin way back yonder before Ben ever was grown. And, I guess he was grown too, but George was smaller. But we just sent everybody a letter that we thought would give us something. And when he got his letter, the preacher was down there talking to Mr. Barr, and he called him. He says, "Brother Marr," said, "I have a letter in here from Louise Graham." He said, "Do you reckon she's home?" And he says, "I think, Mr. Franklin, she went to the river." "Why?" He says, "Well," says, "I want to give Louise a check." he said, well, let me call and see. So he tried to get me, and I wasn't there. So he said, well, I'll see her when she gets here. So Mr. Lightner died, and on his way back from the funeral, you know, Julia works down there, he stopped in there, and he says, Louise, I'll get my secretary to mail you a check in the morning. And boy, he mailed me a check for $1,500. And then when...
And you didn't have a thing to do with it.
Well, I just signed the letter that went to him. But, and everybody said they'd never been, nobody'd ever got any money out of him. But he knew, Mr. Miles, that whenever I ask for anything, it's for, we need it, and it'll go where I say it'll go. He just got that. And so then when we had to buy the furniture, I was on the furniture committee. And Lord have mercy, we didn't have but $300. We went everywhere for
you know, Florence. She's on committee with you?
Yeah, I used to hear her talk about that. It's been so long I forgot about it.
And we were trying to find a living room furniture that we could buy for $300.
Yeah.
Did she tell you what happened?
No.
They couldn't find nothing, and poor little old Florence had, we done walked our legs off, and she had to leave and go to get children, and I went on out to Johnny McDaniel. I said, Johnny, I said, we have $300 to buy a living room suit for our parsonage. I said, and make a note. He said, why, Ms. Graham, that's no problem, is it? He said, just go in there and pick out the one you want, and I'll see what we can do. So I went in, we went in and we picked it out, and that boy gave us a 40% discount. Then we still didn't have money enough. And then he took $69 off of the living room suit. So we got the living room suit. Well, you see, Carol missed down on that. So then we needed another chair. And we done walked our legs off of the God-blamed chair. So my daughter-in-law called me one morning. She says, Nanny, William's furniture out there at the creek's going to bring me a set of twin beds. Will you be here to sign them? I said, Lena, wait, let me see. So I run up there and I picked the chair out. The chair was $90. I told the man, I said, now you know you're going to give me a good discount. This is our church. And I got that lovely rocker in that parsonage for $54. So I give the man the check for it. So the first time Carol Hare come in, she says, well, who picked the chair out? And I don't know who told her. I did. Well, did the committee pass on it? And I imagine it was Florence told her because it sounds just like her. she said, no, the committee didn't pick it out. Said, Louise Graham picked it out. Louise Graham paid for it. And said, as long as Louise Graham's paying for it, I don't think the committee's got a thing to say about it. Don't that sound like Florence?
Yeah. You know, I know Florence pretty well. You know, she talks to everybody. It's easy to talk to Florence. And you know, I just think she's a marvelous child.
Oh, she thinks I'm a piece of gold.
Is that right? Well, I think she is. Oh,
she's
my.
A wonderful old girl.
If I was in the hot water, I'd wish she'd come around. Now, look here, Louis, stick this in and let's tape something. I was just talking to it.
Let's see. It's in here. Is this the microphone right there?
Yeah, there's my. Well, that's it. That's that beautiful tape. Oh, we did talk. Well, you can't talk all afternoon. I tried to get a machine working, and I couldn't do it. She's had it, I don't know how long. She's never been able to record on it. This is Channel 2 right around 200, 205. Channel 2 right around 200, 205. And this is the end of the visit with Louise Graham, the second visit, when we put the tape together of the gospel singing and then her grandson on the organ. A gospel sing on the part of her family reunion. And this Channel 2 right around 205, 205, and that was Friday the 19th of September
69. Well, you wait till I get to tell you, then you tell me what you want. You see,
just anything you say, you see, it'd be perfect, all right.
Let me tell you. Natural. I don't want no put on nothing.
That's
about
right.
That's
right.
That's what.
Yeah.
That's the reason why I guess I'm such a conservative. I want everything left just the Lord made it, and I want that. Right. You know that, were you there when the phone rang yesterday and it was my niece from South Carolina?
No, I missed that.
I sent her the tape that we made down here.
Yeah.
And she got on that telephone. She's been in the bed with a bad back.
Yeah.
And she just was dying because she didn't have a recorder.
Yeah.
And some folks brought in one and played it for her while she was still in the bed.
Yeah.
And she reached over and took the telephone and called me.
Why?
She says, "Lord have mercy, Louise, I wouldn't take $1,000 for that thing." And
right.
She just was, oh, she said, "The way you all did it." And she says, "I'm so glad that you announced and said
talk
what."
Little.
Good gosh, man.
I see.
Yeah. But she was really, and that will mean so much to her that she's in bed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, what, you know what it
Jay was said a while ago yesterday, you know, that. He had got ahead. He was playing faster than the other guy.
I didn't know it.
I didn't either. Shoot, I don't know one note. That's the reason why I just, I'm kind of leery about going in with this man. I know when I get out there and I hear anything, I know what I enjoy and what's good. But,
yeah.
Of course, we'll get our money back because, Lord, he cleared $1,700 on the Ernest Tubbs show down there. Then they have some of our own talent to kick the show off, about an hour and a half. Well, that's where me and my little group's coming in. When he called me and asked me if I'd help him financially, I says, "I will under one condition, under two conditions." And he says, "What's that, Ms. Griffin?" "That I'll bring my own talent down for the kickoff, and there will be no whiskey and drinks and loud doings." I said, "Mr. Livingston, I've lived this long without it, and I'll have to live on."
Now your enterprise. I mean your business. Or whatever it is.
Well, I'm much interested in this young man that's over at Chiefland. He lost his arm when he was 6 years old by climbing a telegraph pole and to get a squirrel, and the electricity injured his arm and he took infection. So I found him about 3 months ago. And I found out that he could play this guitar with one arm, one hand. And naturally, as much as I love trying to help people and trying to bring it out, I just felt like I should go to bat for him. And Ernest Tubb was appearing in part of the Grand Ole Opry program down at the Winter Haven last week. And I managed to squeeze SJ in for one number. The man was kind of leery about putting him on because he figured, well, he did look kind of woebegone, and if he was as great as I said he was, I should have had an appointment set up for him. But I knew if I ever got on there one time, that's all I needed. So he finally told me he could have one number. And of course, the Texas Troubadours and Ernest was there. And little old SJ, when he finally got on, well, he cut loose on that Wildwood Flower, which is a Grand Ole Opry's theme song, and I'm telling you that the housetop liked to come off.
Yeah.
And they clapped him back 3 times and would have had him more, but it was 12 o'clock at night and the lights were supposed to be turned off at 12:30. And so as soon as the program was over, this Mr. Livingston that I had to almost jump over to get him on, he says, "Ms. Graham, where can I get in touch with you?" He says, "I've got to have that young man back down here." And so I gave him my phone number, but before I left, he came and he said that Loretta Lynn was showing the 12th, and could I bring SJ back down? And I said, "If that Pontiac will run, I can bring him." So we got him set up for the 12th. So then a week later, Mr. Livingston called me and asked me if I'd like to go in with him. He needed a little financial help. He was getting a bigger building. And I told him the only way I would do it was under two conditions, that I could bring my own talent to kick the show off, that I had far better talent up here than what he had down there the other night, while my little folks here could just run circles around what he had down there.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. And I said, "Then I will not tolerate where there's drinking and any rough stuff." I said, "I've lived 61 years without that, and I'll have to live the rest of them without it." So I'm supposed to go down Wednesday to look the situation over and sign what necessary papers there is to sign. he's doing all the advertising, and I've got to see about getting the insurance. He thought I could get my insurance through the company that I have up here, but I called Mr. Ferris this morning, and he said the best thing to do is to go down, and he knows that the building is up with fire and wind and all like that, and then just have our liability clause added to that, and he said that would be so much cheaper than to just go and have to get fire and everything. And so he advised me just to go down to Winter Haven and find out what company the building is with. And he said he wanted me to take over. He said, in other words, that I think we need some new voices and some new blood. And he said, as much as I saw you the other night, he said, the determination that you have, says, I believe you put over what you start to do. And said, that's the reason why. I said, I told my wife, I said, that's one of the nicest people I've ever met. And said, she wasn't with me 10 minutes before I found out that she meant well and everything had to be on the up and up. And I feel like she's honest and I can trust her. And he said, I want you to do the book work, sign the checks and everything. In other words, I think he's such an old grouch that he figures that maybe I can take it over better than he can. And I believe I can, because it might be, you know, that he has a little resentment down there, and so that's the setup.
A little fresh blood.
A little fresh blood.
Well, now, do you stand to make a little money?
Oh yeah, we'll go 50-50. After all the expenses is paid, you see, we pay in Loretta, we have to pay her $2,200, and the building, if we rent it by the night, it's $500 a night, but if we can lease it for 6 months for $2,000, so we're gonna lease it for the 6 months and get our insurance for the 6 months, because we have another big show coming up 29th.
Yeah.
So that.
Oh yeah.
Don't you think that's a pretty good deal?
Yeah, yeah. You just can't afford to do it for the night.
No. I couldn't do it.
Why are you interested in the feasters?
Well, because I am one.
Well, the feasters now, or the feasters as they were?
Well?
I mean, you know, the...
I really appreciate the older ones better than I do these younger ones, but because some of the younger ones does things that I don't especially care for, and I'm just interested in history, in family history, because after all, we had some wonderful people. Our forefathers were.
Well, give me two or three just sort of high points. You know, things that you have talked about a lot.
Well, my grandfather, you know, my great-grandfather, when he was up in South Carolina, he was one of the first settlers out there in Fairfield County.
Yeah.
And they migrated from, Feasterville, Pennsylvania, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
See, when they come from the old country, they landed in Pennsylvania, and they lived there several years, but my great-grandfather said that they could not worship God in the way they wanted to, and so he said that he was going south, and they started out, and my great-great-grandfather was real old then, old Peter Feaster, and my great-grandfather wanted to wait till his health got better, and Peter says, no, said, let me go, let's go on, let's start, and said, if I die on the way, bury me anywhere, says, any spot you can put me just as close to heaven. And it's all in this history that I'll have to let you read my history book when I get it back. I sent it, they're having the centennial up in South Carolina in 1970.
You mean you just have one copy of it?
No, I got two copies of it.
Oh.
My nephew's using, he's got one, getting his notes,
yeah.
But... And so then anyhow, they came on down by covered wagon, and sure enough, poor old Peter died, and they buried him in Virginia. And they come on as far as Savannah, and the Indians drove them back, and they turned around and went back and settled at Feasterville, Fairfield County, South Carolina. Well, then my great-grandfather, he was a great lover of music. I guess that's where I get mine from. This Mrs. Laird had come up from down here, and she was a music teacher. So he asked her if she would teach music up there. He said, I will build the building, and pay you so much a month to teach all the young ladies around here. And we had people, one of my cousins went from down here to go to school.
Oh.
So he built this big boarding house for the students, and then the little music schoolhouse is right near it. Of course, they call it schoolhouse now, but it was used later for school. And we still keep that boarding house intact. We just put a new roof on it and painted it. And they put a bathroom and all in it. Now, if we go up and want to stay over the weekend, we can go there. They made little apartments out of it. And and they take my great-grandfather's picture back when we have this big reunion.
Yeah.
The fourth Sunday in July of every year. And people from all over the United States come.
Oh.
And, you know, our cousin that J.P. Feaster, that used to was governor of Mississippi two different times, and he's attorney general at one time, and now he's a supreme judge. But he comes over and he generally is the master of ceremony and gives us a talk and all. And I say, we really have some good blood in these old Feaster veins.
Oh goodness, I never knew that. Now, where is the place?
Near Winnsboro, Fairfield County.
At Feasterville.
The little community is Feasterville.
Well, that's remarkable.
And I've got, I went up and I took pictures of the cemeteries and all, and I've got the dates that I took up close where I could get the dates.
Mm-hmm.
And, Mr. Miles, if you love antique things, you ought to go up there with me. They've got three great big homes there. One of them's not even, they don't even live in it, but 10 days before the reunion, see, we had three Feaster men to marry Coleman girls.
Uh-huh.
So we had the Feaster, Coleman, and Mobley reunion. Well, my great-grandfather married Drusilla Mobley,
uh-huh.
And then she had all these girls and boys that's married into the Coleman. So that's, we had the Feaster, Coleman, and Mobley reunion. And, this big home, the three Coleman girls use it. They have it. But they all teach and always somewhere else, but they come home for about 10 days ahead of the reunion. And they go there and open that big old mansion up. And those old big old high beds and feather beds, you have to curl up on the ladder. And the only thing that they've changed is their kitchen. They have a washing machine, an electric stove, and of course the water. But outside of that, everything was left just like it was 100 years ago.
Well, I think that's remarkable.
The same old beds and everything. I made them let me lay down in that old feather bed.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go every year, but I haven't been for 2 years now.
Well, now, you know, that's all new to me. I just figured the Feasters were some people who lived out there where Gladys and Lynn live, and they sort of petered out.
Mm-hmm.
See, Lynn's been sick so long. And I didn't know you.
Well,
was
now
the
you see,
Feaster.
There was three men come to Florida in 1831.
Yes.
My great grandfather, John M. Feaster.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Simulton's people that have Simulton's ranch over here, and Mr. Giger's folks.
Uh-huh.
Well, my great grandfather settled where I am. He had 7 sections. Mr. Simulton come out here, and Mr. Giger went to Waukehude. Now that's the way they settled. Now that was the starting of this little community.
Yeah.
And I have the old Simulton china that come down. Mr. Jimmy gave it to me because he said he felt like that I would enjoy it and appreciate
Why?
It. Yeah.
Is that right?
I've got the old china right in there, and I've got the one that my great grandfather brought back too. So I got 2 sets of dishes that come down here by covered wagon.
Yeah.
And the Feasters and the Simultons was real, real close. Now, the Giggers didn't come in too good. I mean, they all come down together, but the younger generation. But Mr. Simulton and my father, they'd call each, all of we children used to say Uncle Jimmy and Aunt Belle. And, my father brought my grandfather brought 50 slaves down when he came. He was one of the richest men in South Carolina. And, so was Mr. Simulton. And, when he come right on out here and settled where Florence and them live now. I could tell Florence Heath about her place.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, when you go back there, the first time...
I don't think she knows it passed back behind where Billy Richardson got it.
Oh, Lord, yeah. Long ago. The first time my sister and I went up, we had planned to go, and my car tore up on me. So I called in Jacksonville, and I said, I will not be outed. I'm going. So we took the bus, and we went up there. When we got to Columbia, we didn't know anything about where we was going, anything. I just had the card where they'd sent it. And the way they got in touch with me, of course, it was all on records when my grandfather had come down here. I had this there, Miss Hamilton. She'd send papers back up there that where I had had my reunion down here, and some of the people in with her connection, and the Hurlongs and all, read it, and so then they got in touch with me and put my name on the mailing list. It was 3 or 4 years before I got a chance to go. But anyhow, my sister and I went. We got us a U-drive car when we got to Columbia. And here I went out through those mountains, and my sister was the craziest thing. She was scared to death. And we drove up to this gorgeous big old home with those great big old posts. And I blowed the horn, and this little lady come out, and I said, can you tell me where the Feasterville boarding house is? And she says, why, yeah, you just missed it about a quarter of a mile. I said, we got a sign to put up, but we just haven't got it up yet. She says, have you come up to the reunion? I said, well, I sure have. And she says, may I ask who you are? And I says, well, I'm Louise Feaster Graham from Macanobie, Florida. And Lord have mercy, Mr. Miles, she hollered, and when she the people just flopped down there. I told my sister, we'd been Mr. and Ms. Roosevelt. We wouldn't have been any highly more welcome. So you see, we were driving that U-drive car, and but they had the table off. The old kitchen was way off. You know how those old houses were. Well, we had to walk way out that plank to the kitchen. Well, there they had that table. They'd pulled out all that Coleman and Feaster china and silver and crystal. Oh, that crystal with that old English C on it. Got out of heat rather than they had the old Coleman dishes, because I could have enjoyed my food better. But anyhow, we stayed and had dinner with them. And then we had to carry our car back in. So there was a lot of kin people there in Columbia. John Feaster Coleman. So before we left there, they called and says, now, Feaster, we going to send these cousins, and said, they want to go to the motel, but we not going to let them. So anyhow, they took care of us that night, and the next morning we all went back out to that the meeting, and it was the most marvelous thing. And when we had to get up to introduce ourselves and tell where we was from, oh my Lord, time the thing was over, the different people come flopping. Well, Lord have mercy, Louise, Miss Graham, we have wondered and wondered and wondered whatever happened to some of the descendants of John M. Feaster. We've been right working on this history, and that was one link we couldn't tell about. And, oh, they were just the proudest thing to see me. I'm telling you, it was just down this world.
How long's that been, Louis?
Oh, that was back in about, I imagine about 1943.
Oh, that far, So
oh,
you've
yeah.
been in this long
yeah,
time.
I've been going a good bit.
Goodness.
And so then my brother John Feaster, I carried him up one time. Mm-hmm. And you see, then he had a little son that was John Feaster. So we had the seventh. No, we had the 8th and the 9th John Feaster there. And boy, did we get a welcome.
Yeah.
Because and my brother John is a whole lot like my great-grandfather. Now, that
now is John the one that lives on Archer Road?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one that sings so fast. Don't keep up, won't let us keep up with him. But anyhow.
And his voice doesn't carry on the tape.
He don't have much music in his voice. You see, he just, those homeless people, the more they can holler, the better they like it. I don't
know. He'd like that one.
But anyhow, when we went up that time, they took down all the notes and all that I had. And then they carried me around to these three great big homes and showed me all these things. And one is John Christopher Columbus Feaster. And it's a lot, all of my great-grandfather's stuff is right there in that old house. And you know them old beavers won't give me one thing out of that. I told Cousin Julie Harback, I said, now Julie, I said, let me tell you something. In one sense of the way, word, I've got as much right to as they have. Because I was a Feaster and they was a Coleman. I said, now Cousin Julie, I said, I don't tell you. I said, both of us are getting old. I says, I want you to make it out your will and leave me one little something out of this house. It was my great-grandfather. The old secretary and the desk, and the, she could just give me a chair. But I do want you to read my great-grandfather's will. Every slave he left him a horse, 100 bushels of corn, a milk cow, and 10 acres of land, so that they could make a living. As the funniest thing in this history book, he wills his children from his slaves. His first child goes to these slaves. The first child goes to somebody, and the second child. Will the young'uns away before they ever born. That's what killed me. Even on down to the 9th and 10th child, he's got them placed before, of course, they was freed before all that happened. But anyhow, you see, the slaves took their master's name. And every time I go somewhere, I look in the phone book and I find Feaster. I went to Philadelphia. I went to Philadelphia and I called. I found a Feaster. And Lord, son, she answered. I knew she was a colored woman.
Yeah.
And she says, lady, says, I've had a lot of people to call me. Says, I want to tell you now. Says, I'm colored.
Mm-hmm.
But says, I can tell you. Says, my people came from your people. And says, that's where we get our name, from your family.
Yeah.
And she says, I would love to meet you and know more about our master's people. And they're all real nice. And down in Miami, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And,
well, it's all the old ones are nice, Louise. It's just the younger ones is sort of.
Now, when Juanita was working in the county judge's office, one of our old descendants, Aunt Mary Griffin, she died. But when her baby was born, she sent for my father. I can remember that. And she says, Mr. Johnny, says, I'd love to name my little son after you if you don't mind. Papa says, well, Mary, that would be an honor. Says, I wouldn't mind. So she named the little old nigger boy John Feaster Harrison. So when Aunt Mary died here 5 or 6 years ago, see, Juanita was still in the county judge's office, and she had the probate work. So Harry McDonald just threw the will over there. He says, here, Juanita, that must be some of your kin people. He says, you go ahead and tend to it. And it was John Feaster Harrison, and it was a nigger.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we got a lot of history back
there. Oh, that's all just, now, you know, and all they see of the old families is somebody who's run down.
Well, yeah,
now you take down McIntosh. All you've got is a lot of old widow women.
Everywhere else.
Yeah.
But now there's one link in my history, and I would have given anything in the world if someone had made just one little note. Now, my great-grandfather married Kizanna Pickett, and she had beautiful big brown eyes, and when anybody sees us with brown eyes, they'll say, we got the Pickett eyes. But now, the John Feasters are light-complected, blue-eyed, and sandy hair. Then when we get our black eyes and dark hair from the Picketts, well, there's no record of where my great-grandmother, Kizanna Pickett Feaster, came to Florida with Grandpa. We can't even find where she's buried. And I have searched these cemeteries out and out, and I've had all records searched to see she, during the yellow fever, see my grandfather lived at the big freeze. He left from here, my great-grandfather, and went down to Titusville. Now, there's a Feasterville church down there that he built. And I've been there here about 8 years ago. We went down in the old benches put together with the pegs.
Yeah.
And each window is in that little church is for some great feast of man, except two, and that's feast of women. And my great grandfather's window is right back of the pulpit. It says John M. Feaster, pioneer of Feasterville, South Carolina, come to Florida 1831 and on down there and whenever he went on down there. And they wasn't using the church, but it was open.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in.
Where was that?
Down at Titusville, LaGrange.
Yeah.
And, I got just all of them in pictures. You just have to come spend the day with me and I'll show them. And so I wrote a little note and left it in the little collection plate.
Mm-hmm.
the second time I went down, the first time no one was using it, but the second time I went down, a branch of the Baptist was using it until they got their new building completed. And so I wrote on there, I didn't even know who was using it at that time, and I wrote on a note there and I said, I am the granddaughter, the great-granddaughter of the John M. Feaster whose window is directly back of the pulpit. And I left a check for $10 in the collection place. And Law, I got the nicest letter from down there, and they said they were so glad to know that I had come by and was interested to know.
Well, now, that must be a pretty sizable branch of your family down
there to have all that.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of my family, my mother's people, they were from Erkhart, Germany. And they come down from Plainfields, New Jersey, and settled over here at Seville.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather, that's the first thing each one of my grandfathers done. They build a church, and they build a schoolhouse and after their home. And my great-grandfather had built a beautiful little church over there at Seville, and it burned. And they didn't even have contact with me, but I went over there one time when a cousin of mine come from Chattanooga to look and see if I could find where my granddaddy was buried,
mm-hmm.
my own grandfather. And Lord, they said they was having their sentence, and they wanted me there. And dadgum, when they wrote me, I was in the hospital with this bad leg.
Yeah.
I didn't get to go.
Oh, that's too bad.
But I visit back over there every now and then. But this little church down there at Titusville, and my grandfather...
I'd love to see that.
He's, my great-grandfather left from LaGrange and went just 4 miles into Titusville, and his old home still stands. I've got some big... And he gave the land for the cemetery. And so there's only 3 graves in the big lot that he had there. And I've been going down. Every time I go through, I'd always go to the cemetery. So 3 years ago, I had a letter from the Cemetery Association down there. And they said that they had found out that I had been down, and that as I didn't have but 3 graves in the cemetery, and it didn't look like anyone would ever care about being buried, and said I was the only one that sent money for perpetual care for it, and that if I would deed them back one lot, see he had 2 big lots, that they would take care of the lot that had the 3 graves in it where my great-grandfather was buried. And Uncle Adjie McCrory. And so I said, well, none of the rest of us would ever be buried there. So I got my sister and I contacted everyone. And they said, well, Lord Louise, you're the only one that ever sends any money down to help with it. Says, I feel like you're the only one that ought to have to say so about it. So anyhow, I deeded them back the extra lot. And they are supposed to care for my grandpa's lot as long as right on, perpetual care. But that's my great-grandfather. And then my grandfather's buried right there back of my house in the little family cemetery. Well, now you talk about some history. It is history. When during the war, my father was right little. Because, see, my father was 87 years old. When he died, he was born in 59. So he can remember when the war between the states. Well, anyhow, they got word the Yankees was coming. And my great-grandfather took out all of the silver and the china, the money and Confederate bonds and everything like that, and buried it. Well, we knew that it was a plat somewhere in that old house where that money was buried. Have I ever told you that story about that?
No,
My aunt, my great aunt, Elizabeth Feaster, which was my grandfather's, John M. Feaster's sister, she married Benjamin Randolph Rives, R-I-V-E-S. And the old house went to her branch of the family, John Feaster Rives. Aunt Lizzie and Uncle Benjamin had 4 children, and cousin Eddie married a Johnson. Well, they had 4 children. So, anyhow, Feaster got the old home there where my house is sitting for his part. Well, that's what he wanted. He knew that plat was somewhere. Well, cousin Eddie, his father had done tore all the ceilings and floorboards and window facings and all out looking for it.
Oh.
and never had found it. So he wanted that house.
That must be some story.
So my, this is true. So anyhow, my father and Uncle Andrew, his brother, offered Feaster $5,000 apiece if he'd just leave the house there. He said he wanted to tear it down and build a place in town. Papa says, well, son, says, you won't get that much lumber out of the old building. Says, when you tear it down, it's going to be, it's going a lot, you're going to lose a lot of it.
Yeah.
But he knew that that plat was in that building. So, anyhow, he wouldn't accept it. He tore the old building down and built him a little old house in town. Well, the year that Hart and I was married, Mama and Hart and I used to sit up every night watching. These gold diggers was digging, trying to find out where that place was. And we'd sit up till 2 o'clock in the morning, nearly freeze to death, and we'd take brush brooms. We'd take brush brooms and brush around the hole. And it was right there between the highway and the pond where they was digging.
Yeah.
Mr. Miles, they dug up an oak tree this long big, trying to find that money. We never did find out who was digging. So, blessed Lord, about 6 months after Hart and I was married, we was living down in Auburndale in Winter Haven, right where I'm going. I got a telegram from Mama, and she says, nothing seriously wrong, but come home this weekend if you can. Well, you see, it was nothing fenced or nothing all out there. It was all open range, just woods out there where my house is.
Mm-hmm.
Down below my father's place was the only thing in cultivation. So Hart and I come home. Bless the Lord, my brother was driving cows south of the pond, and there he had found this big hole, big as this room, had been dug out, and there was the shape of the pot. My mother made my brother take some tin over there and cover it up so it wouldn't rain in it till Hoyt and I got there to see it, because we had watched and tried so hard to find it out. Well, Mr. Miles, and he put the tin over the hole. There was a little old wash pot leg and the shape of the rust that come right out of there. And see what they was doing? They was digging north of us and west of us and east. And our God, the darn thing was south of the pond. And see, when this man tore this house down, it was I got a little ahead of my story. I can tell you, it was in the chimney. We took the bulldozer and cleaned up where our house is right now after we bought the place in 45. We found a big rock that come out of that old chimney, and a little square had been hewed out of that rock, and right there was where the little metal box with the plat was. We see they couldn't get to it because it was in the chimney. When he tore the blame house down, he waited about a year before he started digging, you see. Well, and he didn't spend any of the money. He didn't do anything with anything. Keeping quiet for a while. Well, all of a sudden, him and his wife and two children was having trouble, and he took off. And he disappeared. And no one heard a word from that sucker for 30 years. So I didn't rest. I knew doggone well I was going to find that man one of these days. That was one ambition I had. So someone had told me that he was down in DeSoto County. So I went to the courthouse. I went to the tax collector's office. I went to the sheriff's office. I went to the post office. I went everywhere trying to find where John Feaster Reeves lived. Well, nobody ever knew anything about him. So, where did I find him? A tax assessor. I hadn't been there. And I went there and I looked in the index they gave me the book. And there was RIVES. They called it Rise down there. So I got his address. And Hart never did like for me to mess in anybody's business, you know. But I felt like that was my business, too. It's while I had all that trouble in my leg. I had my leg in the brace. So Hart went on off to work this morning, and I just said, well, I just got the address the day before.
He lived at Napati. It wasn't 10 miles from me, and I'd lived there a year and a half. So I drove up to the house, and I got out with my crutches and my brace, and I went up. There was a man sitting on the porch with him. And I said, "Is this where Mr. Reeves lives?" He said, "No, ma'am." I said, "This is not where he lives." Well, this guy had got up to leave, and he says, "Well, Mr. Rice, I'll be seeing you." He says, "If I don't get home," says, "my wife will give me the devil if I don't get there to eat right on time." So he left. And I said, "Mr. Reeves doesn't live here?" He says, "No, ma'am." He says, "My name's Rice." I said, "Well, it may be Rice down here, Feaster, but it's Reeves where I come from." I says, "You John Feaster Reeves, aren't you?" And he says, "Well, who are you?" I says, "Well, I'm Louise Feaster Graham." And he says, "Well, come in, Louise." And he said, "No, when I come off down here," said, "you know, my wife and children got me in such a fix. And said, I just wanted to wash my hands of the whole affair. And said, I just didn't change my name. I just changed the pronouncing of it. But anyhow, when I asked him, I says, Feast, I says, you look at me. I says, you got the picket eyes the same as I have. He's got big old brown eyes, you know." And I said, and we look a whole lot alike.
Yeah.
And that's the way I know him. I knew that I hadn't seen him in 30 years, in 33 or 4 years, don't guess.
Good Lord.
But anyhow, I knew him.
Now, how long has that been since you...
1956! So anyhow, I sit right there and talk with him about 2 hours. I says, "Feast, come on, go home with me." I said, "Hoyt will be so proud to see you." He says, "Lord Louise, I have to eat nothing but bananas and milk." I said, "Well, I'll feed you bananas and milk." So I said, I was anxious to find out something about the old money, you know.
Yeah.
I had mentioned it. And so anyhow, I told him all about the family. I said, "Feast, did you know that Elton has been in the Veterans Hospital for years?" He says, "Well, Louise," he said, "I've kept in contact," says, "I knew how things was going," said, "I just couldn't let them know where I was." And I says, "Well, do you know that Eunice, that's his daughter," I says, "she's married to H.M. Brown. She lives just a mile and a half." I says, "She lives up there on the old Balk Knight place, right on up from the old home." He said, "Yes," he knew that too. And he wouldn't go home with me, though. And I asked him about Cousin Mamie. His sister was living in Macon, Georgia. Well, I knew where she was living, because that's where I got the other old table from. Every time I'd go through Macon, I'd go see her. See, we got two old tables that come over from the old country. My father had one, and the Reeves family had one. And so I had had mine restored, and Cousin Mamie had always said she wanted me to take mine back to the hill. See, I bought the property from the Reeves heirs in 45. And she said she wanted me to have the old table to take back to the old Feaster plantation. But I was so scared I wasn't going to get it, but I did. Her husband called me when she died, and I went up and got it. But anyhow, I asked about all of them, you know, and he told me how good Mamie was. And so when I started to leave, I said, "Now, Feaster, I'm leaving right here in Arcadia. If at any time you need me, you just let me know." So it wasn't but about, I guess about 6 months, and he took real sick. And he got my address from the post office, and they sent out to my house to see if I could get in touch with his daughter here in Macon-Opie. And in the meantime, I had come back to Macon-Opie. So the sheriff's office called me from Arcadia and asked me if I could get in touch with Eunice Rives Brown, and I said yes. And so he was real sick and was in the hospital, and Eunice and H.M. went down and stayed 3 or 4 days with him, and that's the first time she had seen her daddy since she was a little bigger.
Isn't that amazing?
And
now,
so then...
You the one that...
brought them together. So then when Cousin Mamie passed away, she had this big old three-story house in Macon, Georgia. And Gay Williams, her husband, he says, "Now, Louise," said, "Mamie loved you and said, I know she'd want you to have anything that's in this house." And now she made a will. And she says, after the funeral, I carried Eunice up. See, that was her own niece. He says, "After the funeral, we want to go down to the lawyer and read the will." so we stayed over and we went down, and she didn't make a bit of provision for Eunice. And her, she had sold Eunice's father's place down at Arcadia where I found him for $8,000, but she didn't make no provision for Eunice in the will. But he says, now I want to give Eunice a little money, and said, I want y'all to take this will, and anything in this house that's not in this will, I want you all to have it. Well, brother, I broke 40 locks. I was the biggest and the strongest one in the group that day, and every darn closet and trunk had two locks on it.
Oh.
Well, it wasn't just a few things that was in there that was in the will. So that's where I got this set of china that come from my grandfather. And Mr. Miles, in old calendars and everything was rolled together, there was those Confederate bonds. They was rolled up like this, two or three of them. We got a fog of them. And they come out of my grandfather's, that thing he found in that hole. And those are hand-painted vases and things up there that's in my china closet.
Yeah.
Come from up there, her place.
Yeah.
I got an old tuxedo that must be 100 years old.
that's just amazing. That's just amazing, Louise.
Well,
I never heard anything like that in my life.
Well, people, when we tell that story about that gold digging, they think that's a tale.
Yeah.
But it ain't. Right where my sister's living, Hart and my mother and I would sit up. I never forget, we'd take us a lunch, so if we got hungry, we could eat to keep from going to sleep. And we watched for them darn things. I'll bet you for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And so then after Hart and I was married and moved on down yonder, Mama was so anxious for me to see it.
Yeah.
But, I'd give anything in the world. Of course, I had to buy the old place back, but I got that 145 acres from Robert after the old house was moved. After my mother died, you see, my father said if we had owned the property when my mother died, Papa said he would love to have buried her then, a little family cemetery. So after Mama died, I wrote Robert again. He was in Arcadia, and asked him if he'd ever made up his mind to sell the old place. And he wrote me back. He said, Louise, I've got to do something with the old place up there. Said, because I'm getting up in age. He says, I don't ever want it to go out on the Feast of Famines. And he says, if you'll send me $800, you can have it. Boy, I didn't even send it to him. I went to the bank and got me a cashier's check for $800. And my father and I got an automobile, and we went down, we bought it. And so then it's the little 3 acres out in the pond and that went extra, and I give him $40 for it. So $840, I got the old place, but up 145 acres. But see, and I have made my will. It's never to go out on the Feast of Famine. It's never to be sold, because the old family cemetery is back then. You see, I've restored the cemetery. It was just out in the woods. It's 17 graves in the cemetery. I know who's in there, but I don't know where each individual is, only my grandfather and my great uncle now and Aunt Lizzie. Now, where Lynn Feaster comes in, see, there was three Feaster men come down